The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday weekend. The most influential voice of the Jewish community in North America is the UJA Federation of New York. And this evening, you'll be hearing from their chief executive officer, Eric S. Goldstein, who tells us what is happening in the Jewish community is a reflection of what is occurring in American society at large.
The Jewish community is no different from the broader community. We have become enormously polarized, and there's a stridency and energy at the extreme left and the extreme right, and this middle, which I still think is the most numerous in terms of numbers of people, has become the most silent with respect to voice. And I think that people in the middle almost don't want to get swept up in the undertow of taking a position that then the right or the left just attacks.
And we'll have a potpourri of some of our other regular features to fill out the hour for you. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, November 25th. The charitable sector in the United States is increasingly top-heavy, with a growing amount of philanthropic power held by a handful of very wealthy individuals and foundations, a trend that poses risks to the sector's effectiveness and independence, a report from the Institute for Policy Studies finds. John Hopkins University announced a $1.8 billion commitment from alumnus and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg in support of undergraduate financial aid. It is the largest ever gift to an academic institution in America. The share of Americans volunteering has been on the decline for 15 years, hitting a low of 24.9% in 2015, the most recent year studied. However, those who do volunteer are giving more of their time. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation has announced grants totaling more than $280 million in support of efforts to remedy harm and reduce the risk of future harm to the natural resources that were affected by the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. A group of scholars is creating the Journal of Controversial Ideas. They will print worthy papers from any discipline and stand behind them regardless of the backlash. One unusual feature of the journal is that they will give authors the option to use a pseudonym. A new study by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania strongly suggests that limiting social media use to approximately 30 minutes per day may lead to a significant improvement in well-being. And finally, one of the most anticipated issues of the Chronicle Philanthropy is when they rank the biggest charities in America. But this year, there have been some significant changes as to how they go about doing it. And here to explain those to us is Stacey Palmer, the editor-in-chief of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Good evening, Stacey.
Thrilled to join you.
What are some of the changes that you've made to this year's rankings?
One of the things we decided to look at is how much cash people get. And we decided to exclude things like the amount of real estate or food or other kinds of donations that are really can often be significant sums, but that's not about an average American sitting down and deciding which charities to support. When you write a check, who is it that you think and you care about and that you're willing to part with some of your hard-earned money? And that's what we really wanted to focus on. So the rankings are called America's Favorite Charities because we hope that this gives a picture of what's getting a broad base of support.
Mm-hmm. And you also don't have donor-advised funds on this list this year, right?
Right. One of the things we decided to look at is who's putting the money to work right away in their communities. And donor-advised funds are capturing a lot of dollars. They're a great way for people to put money into what's sort of like a charity checking account and decide over time where they want to give. But that's not money going out the door. So we decided that we will separately track how much those institutions are raising, but we're not going to include them on the list.
Makes sense. So with these adjustments having been made, what organizations stand at the top of America's Favorite Charities list?
You'll have heard of most of the charities that are at the top of the list, and that's one of the things that we wanted to return to a world in which people really saw the charities that they recognize. So number one is United Way Worldwide, and number two is the Salvation Army. I think those are the groups that when you talk about charities, people people think of and say, yes, that's where my money goes, and that's what I think of as a typical charity. But it might surprise you to think about who's 3 and 4, and that's St. Jude's Children's Hospital, number 3, and Harvard University is number 4, and colleges are a very big part of our rankings. They are more than 40 of them are on the list, and they command a large amount of support, and Harvard just raised $9.6 billion in a capital campaign. So, of course, they're raising tons of money every year, and that's an organization that gets a lot of support from private individuals.
You know, I'd be curious, Stacey, how did this ranking of charities by the Chronicle ever get started in the first place?
One of the things we realized when we started the Chronicle is that there wasn't a lot of real-time data about charity finances. If you look in the business press, the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, all those kinds of Fortune, you know a lot about what's going on right away, and it's even many years ago, it was real-time. And in today's world, we're not seeing very much that even still in the charity world that represents what is really going on now. And so we wanted to speed up the idea of here are the charities that are raising money, here's what happened this year. So we started working with charities to say, how much are you raising? Mm-hmm. And then put them in a ranking so that people who are in the arts or in healthcare or in education could see how their results compared to other organizations. Usually people look in a very focused way about, you know, I'm just going to look at all the hospitals, but how does a hospital compare to a college, to an environmental group? And so for the first time, we brought those rankings together.
Yeah, a very nice benchmarking. Well, finally, Stacey, this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Congratulations. So much
Thank
has
you.
Changed in the nonprofit world over that span of time. How do you think your coverage of the sector has changed over these past 3 decades, and how do you think it's going to continue to change in the future?
One of the things that is astonishing is to see the growth of philanthropy. I don't think we ever expected to see as much money transferring into the nonprofit world. To have people like Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg, you know, commit at what might be as much as, you know, $40 billion to charity. That's the kind of thing I don't think we could have imagined back then. There were certainly big fortunes going to charity, but the size of the gifts and the ambitions of these very young donors. When we first started, there was more the model that it was Walter Annenberg at the end of his life deciding where to give. And a really big gift he made was a $500 million donation. We stopped the presses for that and had a special edition. But, you know, that kind of gift today, we might report several of those in a year. So I think the scale is what's so different. And the professionalization of the nonprofit world, it was beginning at the time that we started, but now there are masters and PhDs in nonprofit studies. There are people who very deliberately go into the nonprofit world, study how to deal with social change, how to get better at it. And I think we're going to continue to see a lot of that, which means that there's high demand for our content because people want to know how to do things better and how to learn from one another.
Mm-hmm. More to come. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Stacey.
Thanks for having me.
And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Eric S. Goldstein of the UJA Federation of New York right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Do you remember your first job? We all deserve opportunity, but the frustrating truth is that while talent is equally distributed in the U.S., opportunity is not. 6 million talented young adults in the U.S. are out of work and out of school. Year Up empowers these young adults with valuable skills and connects them to leading U.S. companies. The results are real. 85% of Year Up alums are employed or in school within 4 months of graduating. Support opportunity for all young adults. Visit yearup.org. Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
One of the largest and most prominent philanthropies in New York is the United Jewish Appeal Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, known to many simply as UJA Federation. They raise hundreds of millions of dollars to support a wide variety of social causes, and many consider them to be the most influential voice of the Jewish community in America. And here to tell us more about what they do is Eric Goldstein, the Chief Executive Officer of UJA Federation of New York. Good evening, Eric, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Pleasure to be here.
Amplify on my introduction a little bit and tell us about the mission of UJA Federation of New York.
Sure. UJA Federation is there to provide for the most vulnerable in the community, New Yorkers of all backgrounds and Jews around the world. And we're there to also inspire a passion for Jewish life and learning and to forge stronger Jewish connections at a time of increased polarization in our community.
Oh, yeah. The organization is an amalgamation of several entities, the oldest dating back to 1917. Share with us some of the history of the organization.
Sure, it's amazing. So UJA Federation was started in 1917. World War I is raging. You have millions of Eastern European immigrants on our shores with almost no work, severe poverty, disease. And all of these organizations sprang up to try to address these challenges. And there were not a lot of affluent people in the community, but there were some. And they were being harangued by every conceivable organization to say, fund me, fund me. Mm-hmm. And a group led by Felix Warburg and Jacob Schiff decided that they were going to pick the 24 best, literally cradle-to-grave institutions, and they were going to create a federation for them, and they were going to come together and fund them along with the group. And so they picked, literally, on the graveside, Hebrew Free Burial Society, on the, from the very beginning, hospitals. This is before there's any social safety net, no government funding of health care. One of the four or five hospitals in this group of 24 was Mount Sinai.
Uh-huh.
We actually have the original document of allocations in 1917. We gave a total of $2 million that year. Mount Sinai's total budget in 1917 was roughly $600,000, and we gave them $260,000. So that was the beginning of Federation to deal with the extraordinary needs of the local community.
Mm-hmm. Eric, how has the Jewish community changed in New York, let's say over the last 25 years or so?
Well, first of all, it's become much more diverse. You know, I think we have a conception of Jewish New York as being from Eastern Europe born, Ashkenazi mm-hmm. heritage. And the reality is Jews today are incredibly diverse. They're multiracial, many of them from what we call Eidot HaMizrach, which are, the Middle Eastern countries, Morocco, and many, many more, and beyond that, I think the community has changed in that mirroring the greater, broader world out there. We've become very polarized, very separate, and so there are distinct camps. And our goal, UJA Federation, is to literally try to forge broader community and to take these disparate elements and bring them together around common challenges.
Herding cats.
Herding cats, indeed.
Yeah. Well, those demographics help a little bit to sort of understand the dozens and dozens of health and human service and educational and community-building organizations that you fund and help support. And let's talk about a couple of them. One important area is the elderly aging with dignity. Tell us about your work there.
Sure. Well, first of all, as we know, people are living longer and longer and longer. but you need to sustain the quality of life as well. And there is a desperate need to assist elderly. We also, in particular, deal with Holocaust survivors. I think people would be stunned to learn there are 45,000 Holocaust survivors still living in the metropolitan area, and 40%, tragically, are living at or near poverty. And so we've put a significant spotlight on the needs of Holocaust survivors. Our view is that if there's any part of our community deserving of our support, it is this one. And we're doing all we can to supplement services to this population. But much more broadly, we know that there is a huge aging population and significant need of support. So we are investing in many of the leading agencies in our community, JASA, which focuses significantly on the needs of the aged, New Jewish Home, and many others to help provide support for this community.
Yeah, that's great. This is something the American society has not prepared for, and it's going to really hit us like a tsunami.
Not remotely.
You know, I saw the other day that the number one cause for people to contribute to heading into Giving Tuesday was disaster relief.
Right.
And my goodness, we have certainly had more than our fair share of disasters over the last couple of years. And you have been actively engaged in most, if not all of them. Tell us about some of those activities.
Sure. By the way, let me first, you mentioned Giving Tuesday. Giving Tuesday, most people don't know, was the brainchild, the creation of the 92nd Street Y, one of the UJA JCCs. And they made the decision, in order to allow it to have worldwide reach, to not brand it as 92Y, because they thought that would limit its attraction and its appeal and its receptivity across the community. And now it's been this incredible phenomena of people using the Giving Tuesday platform for charities.
Well, it's certainly become bigger than Black Friday, that's for sure. And
God
Henry
Timms
has been on the show, and
he's a
guy at the 92nd Street Y. In fact, he announced it the first year here, so we've been very closely aligned.
So I've been scooped.
We try to promote it every year, and you can't promote it enough as far as I'm concerned, so thank you for bringing that up.
Back to disaster relief. The reality is that one of the real reasons we exist from the start is to help people who are in serious need every day, but also during periods of crisis. So if you go back to Hurricane Sandy, then Mayor Bloomberg designated five official restoration centers in New York. Four of the five were UJA Federation agencies. But as recently as a year ago during the extraordinary hurricanes in Houston and then in Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, we were there within days providing many of the people who had the expertise from Sandy, literally sent them to Houston to work with the community there. And with Puerto Rico, there was just this enormous need. And we work with many organizations, so we had access to medical supplies. We have lots of Jewish community centers that became collection points. And we have an extraordinary base of donors who actually provided their planes, you know, private planes, corporate planes. We ended up sending 29 plane loads worth of material, over 100,000 pounds of supplies, including, you know, oncology drugs when the main hospital in Puerto Rico was out of them. I went on two of those trips, and they were about as inspiring a day as I've ever spent. We literally loaded up these planes, went with the local Jewish community, which was not as affected in Puerto Rico by what happened, and we would walk into the most dire neighborhoods in remote areas of Puerto Rico, unload, stage all the materials. The community would come and we'd take, and when it was gone, we'd go back and go home. Really wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it really is. That's fantastic. You know, when you were talking about the elderly before, you talked a little bit about poverty and hunger. And that's such a big issue. I'm going to ask you to speak about that a little bit more beyond what you're just doing for the elderly, but really for the broader community.
Sure. Look, our mandate is to feed all of the hungry of New York who need, but our particular focus is Jewish hunger. And I think, again, people would be stunned to learn that there are roughly 1.6, 1.7 million Jews in the five boroughs, Westchester, Long Island. 560,000 people living in Jewish households today in that area live at or near poverty. So literally,
that's a big slice.
Almost a third of the total community living at or near poverty. And it's at a time where we have unprecedented prosperity in our community. And so we've decided to put a significant spotlight on that. We're also doing certain new initiatives that we think have the potential to truly bring people from crisis to stability in much greater numbers. For example, we currently have dozens of food pantries, traditional food pantries across our network. Our goal, we've now done this with four, but the goal is to do them all, is to transform them into what are called digital choice food pantries. The problem with food pantries are, one, you have to wait on long lines, very undignified, very difficult for many, and then you get a standard basket of goods that you may eat, that you may not like, that may be culturally not what you eat, maybe dietary challenges. What we've created is a online system, and if you don't know how to go online, the social worker goes online for you. It's a point-based system that puts online what we have in inventory, and then you get to choose what you and your family want to eat. It also promotes healthy eating so that if you want pasta, it's 5 points for white pasta.
It's going to cost you.
but 3 points for whole wheat pasta, 5 points for fruit, 10 points for cookies. So it promotes healthy choices. And again, it reduces waste, it promotes dignity, and we hope to bring that to all of our food pantries. The other thing we're looking to do beyond the digital choice food pantries, and we did this in conjunction with our centennial, we're now 101.
Right.
But the question was, how do you mark the centennial and amplify your values? And food insecurity is a dramatic challenge in the community, and so we're creating two massive community hubs in the areas of densest Jewish poverty in central Brooklyn, on the border between Bensonhurst and Borough Park, and central Queens, in the Forest Hills, Rego Park, Elmhurst area. And we're turning around and creating these massive one-stops that are going to be the digital choice food pantries, benefits enrollment, social work case management, legal services, workforce development training, all in one location. So you're going to come in for the food, perhaps, but then there'll be this complete workup, and it's based on a model at St. John Bread and Life in Bed-Stuy, where they found that after 6 or 7 months, 60 to 70% of the people were no longer asking for the food. So it really is crisis to stability, and we're looking to bring that to those two communities as well. So it's a huge focus for us now, unfortunately, the need is dramatic.
Yeah, no, that makes an awful lot of sense. I don't think that people appreciate how difficult it can be to navigate the system. They don't know where to go or how to go about it. When you can put it all under one roof and have all the referrals there and all the things, people will actually take steps to make their lives better, which they otherwise would never do.
Exactly right. You know, there are a lot of benefits that aren't taken up because people don't know, they're not aware that they're entitled to them, they don't know how to access, how to navigate, and the idea is to put this all in one place.
You reduce the friction.
Exactly right.
Yeah, it's always one step that stops you, that you just say, oh, I'll come back to it later.
Exactly.
And of course, you never do. I'm going to ask you one more thing about your work, too, because you're talking about food and all the things that you provide, but one of the most important things you provide are people, and you are mobilizing them through your Time for Good effort.
Sure. So strategic volunteerism, it's easier than it sounds, because in theory, you get people volunteer and they come to an agency to do work, all good. The reality is most agencies don't even have the capacity to appropriately bring in volunteers. They don't have the capacity, they don't have people with the training or even the people, just plain and simple, to work with the volunteers. And if you had a bad volunteerism experience, it's one and out. You're not coming back. So we're actually spending time now giving grants to our agencies to train them to be able to bring in and use volunteers in a high-impact way. And this is both the service day kinds of volunteer opportunities, where Martin Luther King Day or 9/11 Day, you bring thousands of people from across the community into your organizations. But probably even more valuable, the high-impact volunteerism are those volunteers who you bring in and who are trained to actually do the work of the agencies. And so you get at a time when the agencies are being asked to do more and more and more with less and less and less, really significant challenge with government funding of agencies. Governments look to these, you know, not-for-profit social service agencies to do this work, but the current contracts are all deficit contracts. And so agencies are not being remotely paid enough, and at the same time, there being enormous delays in the funding of these contracts. So these agencies are giving, like, interest-free loans to the government for long periods of time that they can ill afford. So that's an issue we need to address. But at the same time, to the extent you can bring high-impact volunteers into your agency to do the work you need to be doing and then cost less, that's a win-win-win-win. And you also expose lots of people to the needs of the community, and you hope they get more and more involved.
That's exactly what happens. You get a high-impact volunteer, and pretty soon you have a high-impact donor.
You got
one
it.
Follows
you,
the other. No
one,
doubt about
one hopes.
Yeah. Let's turn the page here a little bit. UJA, Greater New York, was founded in 1939 and 1941, the national and the local organization. Prior to the existence of the State of Israel, and this has been a vital yet ever-changing relationship. Tell us how the organization's relationship with Israel has evolved over these decades.
Sure. So, as you say, Federation was started in 1917. UJA, whose mission was to assist the then not even in existence State of Israel, and also the Jews overseas, Eastern Europe, who were in obviously very much harm's way during that period, to provide for their needs. And the original goal of UJA, which then merged with Federation in 1986, was to provide for the needs of this fledgling State of Israel and for the needs of Eastern European immigrants. Over the many decades, UJA Federation of New York alone has provided literally billions of dollars of investment in the State of Israel. And as you say, the initial stage was state building. Mm-hmm. It was bringing in the millions of immigrants from Eastern Europe and then from Russia and Ethiopia. And then state didn't have the capacity to absorb them into the country. So we brought them there, and then we helped the country absorb all of these immigrants, integrate them, give them the training, housing, the programming. And then we were very much involved in state building, creating the institutions that you need for a civil society. And then over time, you know, one of the great things is we were successful. You know, Israel no longer is a poor country.
Right.
It's a very prosperous nation. It's the startup nation. And, you know, there are millions of successfully integrated immigrants who have changed the face of Israel in extraordinary ways. So then the focus became also beyond still taking care of people in need. There are still lots of people at risk in Israel who are deserving of our support, is to focus on creating a community that embraces both the Jewish and the democratic, so that it's a state that takes care of marginalized populations, Israeli Arabs, ultra-Orthodox Jews, and spends a lot of time integrating the other into community, and we're very much focused on that. Today, and you know, we can get into it to the extent you want, we're also dealing with an incredibly prosperous Israel, an incredibly prosperous North American Jewry. And so there's not community feels an urgent need to connect with the other.
Isn't that interesting how that always happens?
Yeah, you know, right. Crisis breeds connection.
Absolutely.
Prosperity and strength has the opposite effect. And I worry because there's now a growing disconnection between primarily the non-Orthodox American Jewish community, which remains the majority of the Jewish community in America, and Israel. And I am absolutely convinced and, you know, deeply believe that World Jewry was made extremely strong, was made much, much stronger by the existence of a vibrant, strong Israel. But at the same time, Israel is made much stronger by the existence of a vibrant, strong World Jewry.
Yeah.
And they need each other, and they need to keep connected.
Well, along these lines, an issue of grave concern, I think, particularly to the Jewish community in North America, was the suspension of the Kotel Agreement.
Right.
Now, tell us what the Kotel Agreement is, why was it suspended, and what does it all mean?
Sure. So this this is just one of a series of challenges that relate to the religious nature of the State of Israel. The State of Israel, unlike America, does not have a separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
So the religious functions in Israel have state authority. And for a number of years now, the religious functions of the state have been controlled by a chief rabbinate that is ultra-Orthodox. And while the ultra-Orthodox, by the way, for whom I have enormous respect, this is not judgment, but they represent 10 to 12% of the Israeli community, so they're a significant minority, yet they control all state-authorized religious functions. The result is that currently, if I come to Israel and I'm a conservative Jew, I can come as a citizen under a right of return, but I can't get married by the – and it has to go through the rabbinate. The rabbinate won't marry me because they don't acknowledge the authenticity of my Jewishness as a non-Orthodox person. That's a significant challenge. It's hard to maintain a sense of connection and – you know, this is a country who I aspire to live in and be with when the country is saying that, you know, I'm a second-class Jew.
Mm.
And so one of the manifestations of this, Kotel is the Western Wall, the most holy religious site in all of Israel. Currently, if you want to pray at the Kotel, the primary sites where you can pray are broken down by a men's section and a women's section in accordance with Orthodox practice. There's a much smaller sort of hidden in a corner place for egalitarian prayer. And there was a deal struck with the government, with all the parties from the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox right all the way across the spectrum to create a much more dignified prayer space that would be egalitarian. It would be a single entranceway with all the other entranceways to the various spaces. It would be much larger. It would also be monitored and overseen by a group that included non-Orthodox streams. And it was considered an enormous breakthrough after years and years of painstaking effort. And at the end of the day, after the deal was announced, the ultra-Orthodox reneged. The prime minister essentially allowed them to renege. And the result is that this Kotel arrangement fell apart. The reality is it's one example,
right,
a sort of very prominent example, but an example of the...
It brings a message home.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it creates, and it certainly explains the challenge, but it's the hegemony of religious life by the ultra-Orthodox, and given that the vast majority of American Jewish community is not Orthodox, it's really critical, sensitive to the Orthodox, but at the same time we need to come up with a solution in the State of Israel that makes it a homeland truly for all Jews, where all Jews feel at home, mm-hmm, and not simply a subset.
Now, let's bring that challenge back home here to America. And I don't know, Eric, if I ever really fully appreciated how the Jewish community is really simply a reflection of our larger society. And unfortunately, these days, that means deep divisions, strident opinions, even a lack of civility now and again for those who think differently. It's the same thing I see every single day on television with our politics. So how does UJA Federation, which represents all these points of view, get their arms around this and serve as a kind of unifying force?
It's becoming an increasing challenge. And Denver, you're entirely right, meaning the Jewish community is no different from the broader community. We have become enormously polarized, and there's a stridency and energy at the extreme left and the extreme right. And this middle, which I still think is the most numerous in terms of numbers of people, has become the most silent with respect to voice. And I think that people in the middle almost don't want to get swept up in the undertow of taking a position that then the right or the left just attacks. And we've had, unfortunately, examples of people trying to stand up and, you know, these awful email campaigns and demonizing rhetoric. So it's a significant challenge. And I think we at UJA Federation believe that we are one of the few places still which tries to appeal across the spectrum. We're not political in a highly politicized time.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, please come together around common challenge. But how do you do it? It's it's increasingly difficult in this environment to maintain a sense of cohesive community, which is why one of our mandates is actually pushing for programming, pushing to bring diverse segments of the community that otherwise wouldn't engage. We have community events. We call them community events, where we come together across synagogues, across denominations, across politics to say, let's talk.
Yeah.
But it's
a challenge.
Real challenge.
Well, you're the vibrant center, but you got to remain vibrant, and it can be a challenge now and again. Do you ever find, Eric, you have to sort of suppress your own opinions now and again because people will say, oh, he's taking sides?
My wife thinks I vent much more at the kids when I get home because I'm so careful during the day not to, you know, take one side or another.
That's what leaders sometimes have to do.
Yeah, look, the reality is I really do try to keep my personal politics aside. The UJ Federation is an incredibly important institution in maintaining this communal reach. And we lose an essential part of who we would be, who we are, if we lost that. And so we are very careful, but it is increasingly difficult, and I do my level best.
Let me ask you about another challenge, and that's the generation gap and how that shows up for you. And you know, whether it's in the United States or around the world, the Pew Research poll consistently shows that younger adults are less likely to identify with a religion, less likely to believe in God, or engage in religious activities. Is that a big challenge?
It's a very significant challenge. Look, we're not necessarily promoting religious activity.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to feel Jewishly connected and feel a sense of strong Jewish community. If they want to observe religiously, God bless. And if they don't and they want to be more culturally connected, we're looking to keep the Jewish community connected and to keep what is a thousand-year-old extraordinary tradition alive and vibrant. But you are entirely right. Our children are more universal in their outlook and less particular. And it is an increasing challenge. It's also part of the blessing. There was once a time where, you know, there were both visible and invisible boundaries and, you know, barriers that prevented our kids from going to any college, going to, you know, for us to get involved in any charity, to us to go to any club. Today, you know, there's enormous blessing of acceptance. Jews are accepted in America. And there's something very, very wonderful about that.
Absolutely.
And we need to understand that blessing. The challenge for us, though, is if you think we have an enormous series of traditions and values to reflect upon the world, to be a part, to bring to the world, we need to maintain the particular, but realize that we need to be part of the universal. So the fact that we maintain a particularism isn't to the exclusion of being part of the world and truly invested, but I think our particularism really sort of grounds us and gives us a mission and gives us values that we need to bring to others.
Yeah. I know you grew up in a pretty religious household.
Your dad
was the president of the synagogue, during the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah.
But really, it was in 2001 when you became part of the Wexner program.
Mm-hmm.
That is what really caused you to change your perspective dramatically. How did that happen?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a modern Orthodox community, and so I went to Jewish day schools, but also very much focused on secular education and advancement. But in terms of my Jewish life, most of my conversations until I started Wexner, and I'll explain Wexner in a moment, until 2001, were with other, you know, modern Orthodox Jews like me, the people I saw in my synagogue. And Wexner is a leadership program created by Les and Abigail Wexner, enormous philanthropists from Columbus, Ohio, that was there to inspire Jewish leadership among non-Jewish professionals. I was a lawyer for many, many, many years, and I came to this program, and it was the first time I spent concentrated time talking about Jewishness with the group that was mostly not Orthodox. And it very much broadened my horizon about the Jewish community, its diversity, and the need, even as a modern Orthodox Jew, to be part of a much broader conversation. I think that the Wexner program, I would not be in this role for sure if I hadn't had that experience at Wexner.
The other religion in your house was the legal profession, more or less. Your mom and dad were both lawyers.
Met in
law school and worked together. Yeah. Still do. Your siblings were lawyers. It was probably predetermined you were going to be a lawyer several years before you were born. And you were a leading partner at Paul Weiss Rifkin for 31 years before assuming this job. So I want to ask you this. Were you a little apprehensive to tell your folks that you were leaving the legal profession for this?
Believe it or not, the candid answer is yes. We had always, as a family, self-defined as, we were lawyers. And not only lawyers, we were litigators. We were a particular type of lawyers. And my parents believed, still celebrated their 62nd anniversary on Sunday.
Fantastic.
And still talk about law at their dinner table every night. But they believed and believe it's a noble profession. Mm-hmm. And they truly, strongly encouraged all of their children to go in. I thought they would be a little bit unhappy that I was, going off the road and doing something different. It turns out they were enormously happy with this, but I did have that apprehension.
Tell us a little bit about your fundraising. You just closed your recent campaign, a record-breaking one, at $250 million. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What is your formula for being an effective fundraiser, and how do you create and nurture an effective fundraising organization?
First of all, I think it's one of the most important ingredients for the success of UJA Federation is we build community. I really believe that we're the backbone of the Jewish philanthropic community in New York. And there are many, many people who have their community. This is where they come for events. We have 400-plus events a year that thousands of people come to across the board, geography, based on trades and professions. And I think that you bring together people around, what are the most important challenges that we need to address. And our donors are not simply writing checks. Our donors, the way we figure out how to give the money away is there are volunteers, people like I once was, who sat around literal tables based on subject matter. So if there's a program about empowering, Israeli Arabs, it's a group who's focused on that issue, supported by staff, and they figure out the most impactful way of spending the dollars that we have available. So you actually create this incredibly engaged group of many, many hundreds of volunteers who give away the dollars. And then beyond, I think we prove we have the trust of the community. We've been at this for a while.
Yeah.
I think we have very strong governance, even though it's something to always be very attentive to. And people see that the work we do really makes a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, and you bring a lot of multiple perspectives into each one of these challenges, and that's where breakthroughs occur. Tell us a little bit about the corporate culture at UJA. What about it are you most proud of, which makes it an exceptional place to work? And maybe what would you like to see improved a little?
Look, my sense is that the people who come to UJA, and I am constantly inspired. I mean, I come not from the Jewish communal world or even the communal professional world. My staff, the UJA staff, overwhelmingly could have done whatever they wanted to do in life. They are impressive, smart people, and they choose to work at UJA Federation out of a sense of mission and purpose. And they do it with sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Living in New York, in the metropolitan area, ain't cheap. And there are lots of more remunerative ways to spend your day. But people do it, and they do it with an enormous sense of pride and happiness. So I think that the people, our staff, is extraordinary. Look, my great challenge is, like many organizations that have been around for a while, we have silos. We have, certain buckets of work that all need to speak to each other because there's enormous knowledge that would be equally applicable across. and we need to still break those down. And we're going to be really working much harder on culture going forward, because we need to all recognize that our organization is going to be that much more effective if we really do better job breaking down these
silos. Yeah, I think that's always a challenge for older organizations or legacy organizations as well, you know, because yeah. they've been sort of set up that way, and to mm-hmm. try to break those silos can be a challenge, but they has to be done. And I think also the collisions of the way the world happens these days, everything impacts everything else, and it happens so fast that you actually do need to know these other silos of what's going on there, more so than you ever have.
All right, look, and technology is a piece of this, but frankly, technology alone is not the answer. You need to really change the culture of cooperation, a sense of collaboration across. And so we're going to be working hard at that.
You know, let me close with this, Eric, and we've talked about this in the broad sense, but if you were to narrow it down, what is the greatest challenge of the Jewish community today, and what is UJA Federation doing as its part in addressing that challenge?
Look, I think the greatest challenge of the Jewish community is our lack of cohesion. We are a very tiny people, 14 million Jews in the world, roughly. And I think that we need to do much better recognizing the importance of, despite difference, and, you know, recognizing difference, embracing difference, but to understand that there's a lot more that connects than separates. I particularly worry about the growing Israel-American divide. Again, it's not across the board. It's mostly the non-Orthodox Jewish community with Israel, but it's significant. And on a domestic side, I worry about the state of our social service not-for-profits. Again, I think the government needs to be much, much more attentive. This is not only a Jewish challenge,
sure.
but it's a challenge for our local community. These not-for-profits are the backbone of our community in so many ways, and they are not being adequately funded by government. And, you know, we need to be as efficient as we can as a system, but government needs to both be providing much greater funding in direct rates. You know, they only provide for direct service, and even then at a deficit. And we must close the gap on delays in getting paid, or otherwise we're going to see more and more of these incredibly important agencies have significant challenges.
Well said. Well, Eric S. Goldstein, the Chief Executive Officer of UJA Federation New York, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us what we'll find on your website, and when people go there, what would you like them to do?
Sure. UJAFedNY.org. Come on, you'll see volunteer opportunities. You'll see all the different work we do. We support around 80 agencies across the community and lots of startups across a broad range of social service need. If you have a passion, go online, find out an organization where you can get involved, and it will be a very rewarding experience.
Thanks, Eric. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful, because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Johnny, that's better than most.
That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, you will be visiting 465 California Street in San Francisco and the headquarters of Room to Read, an organization that is focused on girls' education and children's literacy in Asia and Africa. We'll begin with Geetha Murilli, the Chief Executive Officer of Room to Read, and then hear from other members of the team.
Room to Read was founded in 2000 with a very simple goal of bringing books to children around the world. Since then, we've grown to reach over 20,000 communities, almost 12.4 million children, with a focus on literacy and gender equality in education.
I think that you see, even in the meetings that come together, it's like all levels of staff are pulled into meetings and people's voices are welcomed at all levels and taken very seriously at all levels. It's not a top-down, decision-driven organization, which I think is one of our strengths. It really allows creative, different ideas to come to the table. And you see this, too, not just at our global office, but a lot of our best ideas come from the field, come from the people who are closest to the beneficiaries. So that's one of the things that I love most about Room to Read.
The background that everyone has is incredibly impressive, and the level of ambition and drive that everyone has is inspiring. So to give you some examples, I could go around even just my direct team and tell you everything that everyone's working on, but everything that everyone's working on outside of the organization. Like, we have two members of our staff, of our team, who are currently writing books, just books on their own about their lives and topics that interest them. Julie, who's sitting next to me, is a photographer and she does family portraits. I am interested in photojournalism and I do that outside of my work as well. One of our other colleagues is interested in starting podcasts. Like, the people who work here are incredibly talented and driven, and you see that reflected in the work that we do, but also outside of our work and just the drive that everyone has. One example is that one of our colleagues had foot surgery recently, and she's been out of the office for a couple weeks. And on Friday, a couple of us went over to her house and worked remotely from her house to keep her company. And it's just like that type of relationship where we know she's going crazy sitting at home. Yeah, we have the flexibility at work to work remotely, but we can't, but we choose to kind of go and support her and just work together side by side is something that is kind of fun and special.
Similarly, with promotions, we talk about the ability to identify talent all over the organization. We're not tied to traditional promotion policies. We look at people's functional capabilities as well as their aspirational capabilities. How much do they want to contribute to this mission, and what have they done to demonstrate their commitment to the organization's goals?
Is that it's almost a running joke at this point that there are going to be some tears at our all hands meetings. And it's not sad tears. It's tears because the stories that we hear in that meeting when we're all together, they're so inspirational and they move people to tears. And it's, you know, certainly a lot of the stories that will do this are from the field. And when we have, stories from our field offices, our country offices, stories from people who usually work in San Francisco, having the honor and privilege of going and seeing that work firsthand. But it also strikes me, too, that I have personally been moved to tears and have seen my coworkers as well when we're talking about our fellow coworkers.
I wanted to touch on a fun tradition that we have at Room to Read, which is ringing the yak bell in celebration of big events or accomplishments that we have as a team. So I think it's nice because it connects us. It is unique and fun, and it connects us to our history as well, where Room to Read started in Nepal, and with our mascot, Zach the Yak, with books on his back. So whenever we have something fun to celebrate or whenever we hear the yak bell ringing, we know there's a good announcement to follow.
I also like people have interests. There's like a run club here. So in the summer, sometimes people go once a week out running. I ran a half marathon with a few people. Also a book club. I never was part of a book club, so joined that. So I've done a lot of stuff I never would have done at other jobs, and I just really appreciate the family feel here. It's great.
Probably a good 60% of that meeting that happened quarterly was focused on everyone going around through the Skype meeting and through their camera showing a recent picture of themselves and explaining the background of that picture, and then people being able to comment on that. And it was so the main focus of that meeting was really just getting to know each other, and there was a lot that needed to be done, and there was a lot that was accomplished on that meeting. So there were a lot of results that came out of that meeting, but a huge part of it was just getting to know each other and being able to build those relationships. And I think that's so important, and it's something that we really do focus on while still achieving results, which I think is very exciting to see.
I found it really refreshing that the management team here, and specifically my manager, has really prioritized my creative growth, and from developing new skills that I didn't even have when I walked in the door, like video editing, to making that a key aspect of my role that is now a huge passion of mine, and I'm looking to explore further even beyond my work here. To just having ideas and being able to run with them and flesh them out into things that are much larger than a seed. That's been something that's really refreshing, and there's a lot of autonomy and growth that I think is accelerated because of that.
There is a tremendous amount of trust that we have in each other. Trust that even when we mess up, even if we royally mess up, it was not because we didn't try hard or think hard. And that trust in each other goes a really long way, I think, in the teamwork that we have together. And because we are working globally, and there's a lot of room for misinterpretation, misinterpreting emails, misinterpreting WhatsApp messages, misreading something. But because we do have that trust in each other, we're able to turn things around. We're able to make the work move forward.
We recently redid our onboarding materials for our new staff that come on. And one of the things I think externally that a lot of people know about Room to Read is just how fantastic our materials look. Our donor materials, our annual report — I cannot say enough about the annual report — to our website, our newly done website, our blog posts, everything like that. And I think what Megan did pretty recently was she took that same level of care that we throw out to our external donors and people who are interested in our work, and we applied that to our own employees. We have this wonderful travel journal now that people get when they come on.
The third thing is that we hire fiercely competitive people when it comes to things that are non-work related. So come here on Halloween and you will find a very competitive Halloween costume contest where people are dressed up individually or as groups. 2 hours before that, the bathroom will be filled with hairspray and different things happening as people prepare for their Halloween costume. And so somehow we have found people that like that competition in the lighter side of the work.
I'm an accountant here, so I'm sort of indirectly linked to the project work. I don't get to go out and see all the wonderful work that's being done, so all the times it's sort of brought back, and we can see people talk about it, show the videos, and see the kids smiling faces and all the good work we've done. I think it's really cool, so I really appreciate that we do that on a pretty regular basis here.
But one thing that we have done this year, and I just loved, being part of these meetings and everything, is we actually did a focus group afterwards. So we had, as a standard SurveyMonkey thing that we used to gather this information, but then we gathered the different groups at Room to Read. We had supervisors, we had non-supervisors, we had, some for the staff in this office. We had global webinars for our staff around the globe. And it was such an incredible thing to see other people, not just, okay, I answered something and who knows where it goes, but just having that atmosphere to talk with your fellow colleagues, and again, in an incredibly safe, fostering place where you could get ideas out. And it wasn't anything where people were just, kind of griping about, what they didn't like. In fact, it was almost the complete opposite. So many people had so many ideas of, oh, I think we can do this, and I think we can do this.
One of the things I can talk about is professional development, and particularly at Room to Read, I've been so appreciative of the stretch opportunities that I've been provided. I think I was able to demonstrate that I could get my job done, and then as soon as that happened, there were all kinds of opportunities to kind of to stretch my skills, to develop new skills, to roll out initiatives and projects worldwide, which is something that I wouldn't have really thought about doing when I first joined Room to Read. But I think that it was having, you know, supervisors who believed in me and saw that and thought about and provided those opportunities, which has been really critical in my own development and career.
What is the nitty-gritty work that makes you a global office and that makes sure that your team feels like really keyed in and special, and that someone from India and someone from Nepal and someone from the U.S. and someone from Australia and Switzerland can all feel included in this mission, not just as a worker, but like as a person? And I think that always stands out to me consistently in all the work that we do.
I want to thank OT for helping to organize my visit and to all those who participated in this piece. Kimberly Gomez, Julie Ellis, Florence Middleton, Danielle Reichner, Erica Cuellar, Megan Litwin, Brian Kavanaugh, and Sanjana Kubchandani. If you would like to hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and the offices, come to denver-frederick.com. And we'll have posted there for you my full interview with Geetha Murrilli, the CEO of Room to Read. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.